Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to my good friend, Tampa Bay Times media critic, Eric Deggans. He's the author of a great new book called Race Baiter: How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Stick around, and please, don't feed the agitators. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by the Stitcher app for mobile devices. Give it a test drive today at stitcher.com/mrmedia, Mr. Media. I love this free radio app, and I think you will too. stitcher.com/mrmedia. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of Fox News Channel hosts who think they know everything about everything, but, with the exception of Bill O'Reilly, don't have the intellectual confidence to argue facts instead of ignorance in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. This may surprise my friend Eric Deggans, but I think he actually owes Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly a debt of gratitude. Seriously, Eric, think about how many years you kicked around the idea of doing a book without really honing in on the topic or the provocation. Then along comes the no-spin zone guy, host of the O'Reilly Factor, to pluck you from the nattering nabobs of negativity in the media for special attention. Now, you are already a great and talented writer, my friend, but one with a limited platform. O'Reilly made you a star, and even better, inspired you to write a kick-ass book about a subject near and dear to your heart. In Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation, Eric takes the way Fox News Channel and other 21st century media sources, such as the Drudge Report and the late Andrew Breitbart, have given up the conceit of respectful political discourse among rival ideologies and gone to nasty, no-holds-barred racial attacks. His book delves into the stories behind all the buzziest names in modern racial politics: Barack Obama, Shirley Sherrod, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Trayvon Martin, and Al Sharpton on one side, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, Megyn Kelly, Newt Gingrich, Breitbart, and O'Reilly on the other. Now, no matter what side of the political or racial fence you're on, you could learn a lot from this book. Eric Deggans, my friend, welcome back to Mr. Media.
That is like the most awesome introduction, man. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
I'll just say goodbye now.
That's right. Pull the George Costanza. Just go off the stage right now.
Well, now, am I wrong to suggest that O'Reilly perhaps deserves a little credit for noticing your work and, in trying to discredit you, wound up kind of growing the size of your megaphone several thousand times?
I guess. There's always going to be somebody who resists these ideas. And, you know, I've been on Hannity and Combs and fought with both those guys. I had Hannity and Combs, supposedly the liberal guy, opposing me. And I've been on Fox and Friends and dealt with that. And Newsbusters.org, a conservative media outlet, has criticized my work. So there's plenty of people out there who were willing to give me a hard time over what I've been saying. But Bill O'Reilly is a little special. Bill O'Reilly is special, I think, to me, because he's so big, you know, he's so well known, he so dominates his field that it is, it's odd to see that he would take so much time to pay attention to what I say or think or who I am. And he's even made offhand references to me sometimes on his show, as if his audience knows who I am, and I'm sure they don't. And I'm sure he's like said my name, and people are like, "Who is this Eric Deggans guy he's talking about?" But it did give me, it was a convenient hook for the book. But what you'll find, and as you know, you've already read through it, I don't spend a lot of time talking about Bill O'Reilly. And I think I'm pretty relatively fair to him about what he said on race. Now the discussion has moved to the point where the things that he said about race, while they trouble me sometimes, are not nearly as extreme as some of the other things that other people have done. And I spend a lot more time talking about that, I think.
Well, it's funny. I have a little insight into your book, having read a few pieces from it. on the way, talk to you about it even before you started on it. And what I find really interesting in reading the book was that you must have been changing and editing right down to the last minute, because events, your contact with O'Reilly itself in the original proposal for the book, and the first time you did the first chapter for the book, or the introduction to the book, you hadn't actually had that up close and personal moment with O'Reilly. It had all been basically one way.
Right.
So I'm thinking, you know, even now the book is done, we can hold it on our hands, and we'll flash it up. But this is the kind of thing that changes almost on a daily basis, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the great thing and the tough thing about writing a book on this subject is that there's always a new controversy, there's always a new argument, there's always a new scandal in a way. And as I was, you know, my original deadline for this book was mid-March. And as you may recall, you know, Trayvon Martin was killed on February 26th, I'm sorry. And his story, the story of how he was killed and the racial implications of it, really sort of exploded in mainstream media in the second and third weeks of March. After the 16th, when 911 calls were released, particularly. So as I was trying to finish this book, this incredible race-based media controversy was exploding. And I basically had to go to my editor and say, look, you know, I need an extra 3 weeks to get this in the book. And they were kind enough to say, okay, you know, we'll give you that time. And so I had to adjust a chapter I'd already written about MSNBC and Fox News, and sort of put in this information about Trayvon Martin, and I also added it to the conclusion of the book to talking across race and talk about, you know, how do we sort of negotiate these topics with each other, and also Sandra Fluck, you know, what she went through with Rush Limbaugh, that also happened while I was trying to finish up writing the book. So I wound up having to go back to the chapter that I do on talk radio and add that to the beginning of it. So, the great thing and the depressing thing about this is that, you know, I did all that, and I had a section of the book that talked about Breitbart.com and them supposedly finding the scandal involving President Obama being close to an instructor, a black instructor at Harvard, who's supposedly a radical. And now, as the book is coming out, you know, we're just a week or two past a different scandal, you know, supposedly unearthed by conservative media involving Barack Obama, you know, advancing the revolutionary idea that maybe people in New Orleans didn't get all the aid that they needed as quickly as they could have because they were poor and black, you know, and that involved Tucker Carlson, who I also interviewed for the book. So, you know, there's a sense that this stuff keeps popping up, and even though I'm writing about stuff that in some cases happened 2 years ago, some of the same people are involved, some of the same media outlets are involved, and some of the same stuff comes up in different ways, you know, even as the book is about to hit the shelves, so...
Well, and there was one more thing I think that changed since you started working on the book, and that was Al Sharpton coming on full time at MSNBC. And I think people reading the book, or people who don't already follow you at the Times, probably be surprised you weren't that thrilled about Sharpton as an on-air personality. And so, and I find that I want to point that out because, you know, in my introduction and probably in the way a lot of people will take the highlights off the book, they'll be like, oh, well, you know, Eric attacks Fox News or Drudge or Breitbart or whatever. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, MSNBC, which probably lines up closer to, you know, maybe the way you think about things. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But, I mean, you know, talk about the Al Sharpton thing for a minute. You
sure.
It's not like you were jumping up and down going, whoopee!
when he got a show. Well, you know, when he was first, and to be clear, I wrote the proposal for the book and started writing it after he had already gotten a show on MSNBC. Okay. He got his show in sort of the late summer of 2011.
Has it been that long? Really?
Yeah, wow. Yeah. I think it was like August or September. I'd have to check. When he got the show, he started trying out as a guest host in June or July of that year. So yeah, it's been a while actually. And in July, I did an interview on CNN where I sort of said, I'm not sure this is a great idea to have the most prominent black anchor on MSNBC be somebody who is not a journalist and is not even not an information professional. You know, his main stock and trade at that point was being a civil rights activist. And so it seemed like they were handing the keys to prime time to somebody who had not only a history of not practicing journalism, but a history of being an advocate, a very staunch advocate, let alone the fact that he had been involved with very controversial issues such as the Tawana Brawley, you know, allegations and the Crown Heights issue. You know, there are a lot of people who feel like he's not even an honest civil rights activist, even though those things happened a long time ago. And so I felt like, wow, you know, I wasn't necessarily as concerned about the fact that he had a show as I was concerned about the fact that he was very close to prime time and he would be their most prominent anchor of color. And it's turned out that way. And now, in March, we saw that not only was he an anchor, but he was representing Trayvon Martin's family as a spokesman while he was also hosting segments on the Trayvon Martin situation for MSNBC. And indeed, there, you know, I talk about a day, I think it was March 22nd, where he led a rally in Sanford, Florida. He took a break and took Trayvon Martin's parents and put them in front of the cameras and hosted his show, Politics Nation, for MSNBC, finished that, then went right back to leading the rally where he collected money for the family. And I found it interesting that, you know, 2 years ago, Keith Olbermann and Joe Scarborough got suspended by MSNBC for giving donations to Democratic candidates without telling their superiors at NBC News and MSNBC and without getting approval for those donations. But 2 years later, you know, Al Sharpton can do this weird dance where he's representing the family at the heart of a news story that the cable channel was also covering, and no one had a problem with it. And, you know, MSNBC's defense is that they say the role of an anchor is different in cable news, and to some extent they're right about that. And they also say that everybody knows what's going on, that it's all above board, that the public knows who Al Sharpton is, and he's open about what he's doing. And then I think their third defense is that people are watching it. But I've always said to Fox that success is not really a defense when we're talking about journalism ethics or we're talking about the appropriateness of something. And I do think, I say in the book, that this tension between MSNBC and Fox News is something that I think sort of erodes everybody's confidence in journalism. You know, if you can look at MSNBC and see Al Sharpton, you know, toggling between these two roles, or if you look at Fox News and you see the way they talk about race sometimes, you know, it might make you think, well, you know, all media is like that. All media is compromised. All media is willing to sort of put journalism ethics in the side seat or in the back seat when viewership is at stake. And there's, you know, I quote a Pew study, a Pew survey in the book that said that when people talk about media, when they say the media does this or the media does that, often they're thinking about cable TV news. Something like 63% of the people they surveyed were thinking about cable TV news channels when they said, quote unquote, the media. So even though lots more people, numbers-wise, may watch the evening news or they may watch the morning broadcast news channels, and there's newspapers and all kinds of other platforms out there, when people think about what the news media means, quite often they're thinking about cable news. So that's why what they do matters so much more.
But it's interesting. I was thinking as you went through the three reasons. The second reason you cited, you talked about how they talked about, well, he's not a journalist. He's more of an activist. And it's interesting that when he was hired and over time, you and other writers stressed the fact to the public that he was not a journalist and actually helped make the case for what he did later in the sense that you had already stressed that he's not a journalist. And I mean, Joe Scarborough is not a journalist either, and he gets away with things that Mika Brzezinski, sitting right next to him, would not. It's just, it has, the whole landscape has evolved. Last thing I want to ask you about Sharpton. So he's been at it for a year, which I find amazing, and I watch him. Has your view of his work changed at all? Do you think that he's grown into the role?
Well, I always felt like he was an interesting voice, and I do think he brings issues to the table that other people have not, and he has an authority and talks about these issues in a way that I think is compelling. He's run for president twice, so you know, when he talks about what somebody needs to do during a debate, you know, I'm more willing to listen to him than I am some pundit who's never held never tried to win political office. But again, I think the things that trouble me about Al Sharpton's role don't have a lot to do with whether or not he's good at it. What troubles me about his role is the way in which his presence and his activities blend the role of an activist. And now you talked about Joe Scarborough. That's important. He is not necessarily a journalist. He was a politician who moved into working for a cable channel. But point of fact, he's not an activist. He's not somebody who leads a group that is actively trying to get legislation passed.
I don't think I agree with you, Eric.
He's a pundit.
He's a pundit, but I think in his own way, he's always trying to get legislation passed, and he's always pushing, you know.
He may be pushing ideas.
And I think he's pushing them in the same way that the marketplace has changed.
But Al Sharpton leads a nonprofit group that advocates for specific legislation. When a bill comes before Congress, they will hold a rally to support it. I think that's a little different.
Yeah.
We all pundits and media, we talk about ideas. We even say, you know, this bill is interesting, or this is something people should consider. We lend our voice to supporting ideas or even supporting specific legislation. But we don't go out and organize voters to get it passed.
Right.
That's blurring of activities. That's what worries me.
I understand.
Because, you know, frankly, and I think I pointed this out in the book as well. Fox News was criticized for its role in organizing the Tea Party, for its role in publicizing the organizing of the Tea Party, talking about different rallies that were being held, having its personalities host these rallies. They got Sean Hannity had to drop out of hosting a rally that was planned, I think, for Tax Day in a certain year as the Tea Party was forming, because he was too closely connected to the fundraising part of the operation. And so if we're going to criticize Fox News for helping to create an insurgent wing inside the Republican Party, then we have to look at someone who leads an activist group that marshals ideas and political action in kind of the same way. You know, they're not active. They're not advocating specific political candidates. They can't do that. They are active politically in a way that a pundit is not.
Eric, is what Sharpton does any different than former Fox News personality Glenn Beck, one of our we both know from the Tampa Bay market? I mean, is he any different as a black activist than Beck was as sort of, I don't know if I would try to call him a white activist. I mean, neither one of them came to the job as a journalist. I mean, Beck's background is a disc jockey, I think, in Arizona.
Right, right. But again, you know, what I try to get back to is this idea that people want an honest broker in these jobs. We don't necessarily want somebody who is a journalist who can't, a traditional journalist who can't express their opinion. It's obvious that what viewers want to watch in prime time and cable news is people expressing opinions. That's obvious. But I think people do want a sense that they're watching an honest broker, even when that person has a political point of view, that they're not going to distort facts, that they're not going to leave out important facts, and that they are going to maintain some kind of distance from the issues that they're covering, so that they can bring some sort of larger worldview to what they're talking about. And when you have somebody who's directly involved, I mean, again, one of the reasons why Scarborough and Olbermann got suspended is this, you know, NBC's position was that if they had these people on that they gave money to and nobody knew that they gave money to them, then essentially they'd be interviewing somebody that they have directly supported financially, and no one can judge their performance. No one can judge whether they're giving them softball questions or making them look good because they've given them money.
Right.
And so, again, if that's the idea, if that's the standard, if that's what you're worried about, then having somebody who's directly connected to a group that is trying to affect specific political action, you know, I mean, I don't know that people are as conversant with what the National Action Network is specifically involved with to know when they're watching Al Sharpton, you know, hey, didn't he just, you know, isn't his group supporting a specific bill regarding Social Security and now he's talking about it on the air? You know, people don't have that depth of knowledge, but those kind of conflicts are possible.
I want to move off of Sharpton. I have to say about Sharpton, and I've been stunned by how impressed I've been with how smart that man is, and how much better. That's why I asked you. I think he's grown dramatically in the job. I think he's gotten smarter, and you know, you could probably see that if you looked at his career. I forget about the Tawana Brawley thing when I look at him today. First of all, he's about 100 pounds less than he probably was. But yeah. Mostly, I just think he's a more serious, smarter guy. And he's developed a bit of a sense of humor that I didn't think he had before. So let me ask you this. I want to change gears because I don't want to use up all of our time here. You talk about Andrew Breitbart in the book. And Breitbart is the guy who's most notable, many notable things with video, and all of them, almost all of them, have been, you know, pretty suspect. But he edited that Shirley Sherrod video that supposedly.
Well, again, he claims that he did not edit it. He claims that he was given.
He
clips.
Promoted it. He promoted.
He promoted it.
He's
yeah.
He's most attached to it.
He claimed. I'm sorry. That shouldn't use the.
So he right. So he. You know, out there suggesting that this is reverse racism and stuff. But what I want to ask you is, what I found interesting, and this was interesting in reading, is that you said that Breitbart was always available. Everyone had his phone number in the press. You knew how to reach him. And see, to me, I don't respect necessarily what he did, but I respect that he would go toe-to-toe with you and argue about it and support his position with what he thought to be were the facts. Is it
right.
Is he unusual? Was he he's passed now, but was he unusual in that regard? That, you know, did people respect that at least that he could make that case, whatever it was?
I think people in media, one way to get on the good side of a journalist is to be accessible, and so I think people in media like the fact that if you had his cell phone number, you could get a hold of him, and he would talk, and he wasn't going to shy away from talking, and he wasn't going to use access to him as a way to control what you do. You know, one of the things that I think some other players in the sphere do is that they won't allow access. They know that an interview with one of their people is a big deal. So they will control access and use that as a way to control behavior, to say that, you know, you've written a story that we don't like, so you don't get access, or you seem to have an agenda that is contrary to ours, so we're not going to give you access. Certainly anyone can make that decision, but I think journalists love people who are willing to say, you know, I believe in what I'm saying enough that, you know, I'll take on all comers, I'll talk to anybody. And so, you know, strangely enough, you know, the press seemed to have a decent relationship with Newt Gingrich for that same reason. He's very open about talking to people and doesn't, you know, control access, which also gives you the sense that, you know, he's thought through what he's saying enough that you can call him up and say, hey, I want to talk about X issue, and he's ready to go. He doesn't need to be prepared. He's not scripted. When you look at people like Sarah Palin, for example, there's a sense that, you know, they have to prepare themselves for interviews. They're not necessarily as ready to just talk whenever you want to talk to them.
Right. And that makes Ms. Palin, what newspapers do you read? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to answer that question.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think reporters are skeptical and suspicious of people who have to sort of be coached to get ready for interviews, because that makes you wonder if what they're saying is really genuine. So there's a lot of layers to that, to that reaction. But I do think in general, people liked Andrew Breitbart. People in media liked Andrew Breitbart a little more than they would have normally because he was willing to talk.
Well, let me ask you about the process. This is your first book, which we're all of us who know you are very excited for you to have gotten this done. And I wondered what it was, what you most and least liked about working on a book as you compare it to working at, of course, a great metropolitan daily.
Right.
Like Tampa Bay Times.
Well, what I liked most was having the space to really talk about ideas, to really excavate the nooks and crannies of an issue. And, you know, a long time ago, an editor here, finished this story that I'd written one length and I had to cut it down. And he said, man, you really just need to write a book about this. And, semi-seriously, but kind of seriously. And that was what really got me thinking about putting a proposal together and actually trying to write a book about race and media because, you know, so often I would come to these stories and I'd want to say 20 things and I'd only have room to say 5. So that's what I loved about the process. What was difficult about the process is, just there's so much out there. And trying to be fair to everyone. You know, I know that I have a point of view on this, and I know that I've written a lot about this in the past, but I really did want to go to people like Andrew Breitbart and say, I'm just going to try and ask you, I'm going to try to present these issues to you the way I see them, and I want you to be honest with me about how you feel about it, and I will try my best to represent your point of view in the book. And so I really tried to do that. I didn't want to take cheap shots, and I didn't want to leave out good arguments. You know, if they made a good argument, I wanted to put it in there. But that was tough. And also, there was a point when I really started to get just down about all of the material out there that seems to be so negative. It really worried me as I was wading through all of this material. You know, I guess it was when I was writing the stuff about Trayvon Martin, and it had reached a point where the Daily Caller and some other websites were digging into this dead teenager's Twitter accounts, his social media accounts, and digging up these messages he had posted and digging up photos that he had posted and trying to portray that he might be some kind of thug and that somehow that might have justified George Zimmerman shooting and killing an unarmed teenager. And, you know, whether or not you believe, however you feel that situation went down, just the fact that was happening and that there was so much ugliness out there and that, you know, there was a guy who wrote a column basically talking about, you know, why prejudice against black people is justified and why black people are not as smart as white people and why if you see a black person on the side of the road in a broken down car, you shouldn't stop to help them. And you shouldn't, as a white person, go around areas where there are large crowds of black people. And, you know, this was like presented as a message that he was going to give to his kids, who, by the way, were biracial. And it astounded me some of the things people were saying, and it could be depressing when you're in the middle of that. Yeah. So those were some of the tougher things about writing this.
Well, I want to just say, folks, that the book, it's, you really should take a look at it. It has the potential to be a heavy read, but it's not. It's written the way most of Eric's work is. I don't want to say it's a breezy read because that undersells it, but it's anecdotal in parts. It's you get a sense of where Eric's coming from, and sometimes you'll see it, you know, like the Sharpton thing. You might be expecting a different point of view. So it's really good stuff to read.
Thanks, man. And, thanks so much.
My pleasure. And most importantly, you can find Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation, by a person I'm proud to call my friend, Eric Deggans. He's a media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. He does the feed blog at tampabay.com. You can find it there. Mm-hmm. But you can find the book in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now, right here, via Amazon at a great price. Right here at MrMedia.com. If you're looking at the webpage, look down here down here on the page, and you should see a link to the book. Just click on it. You can order it that easily. Eric, do you have a, do you want to send folks to a website or Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
Well, we I do have a web home for Race Baiter that is under construction right now. Hopefully by the Saturday, October 20th, we'll have it up. It will have an excerpt from the book. It'll have some links to some other media I've done, television appearances I've made. It'll give you a list of my appearances, so if you want to stop by and see me in person, we've got a bunch of things planned around the Florida area in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks. So we'll have all of that stuff there. You can go to ericdeggins.com, and it'll be there, or you can go to racebaiter.com, and it'll be there.
Good. And you're also on Facebook and Twitter?
I'm on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter is just @Deggins. Facebook, if you do Eric Deggins, my name, it'll come up. Anything Deggins, basically, is me. Although I found there is a family in Texas, too, that shares that name. So be careful.
Okay. You know? And if you've enjoyed this conversation with Eric, I believe he's been on Mr. Media on audio once or twice before. We'll have the links on this page for that, too. So, Eric Deggins, congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thanks so much for having me, man. This was great.
My pleasure.
You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority, for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.